giving none of the hopeful men lurking at the bar the slightest reason to suppose that she wanted any of them to join her. The second glass of wine made her feel much more relaxed. She remembered how Strike had got so drunk here, in this very pub, that he could barely walk. That had been the only night that he had ever shared personal information. Maybe that was the real reason she had been drawn here, she thought, raising her eyes to the colourful glass cupola overhead. This was the bar where you went to drink when you found out that the person you loved was unfaithful.
"Are you alone?" said a man's voice.
"Waiting for someone," she said. He was slightly blurred when she looked up at him, a wiry blonde man with bleached blue eyes, and she could tell that he did not believe her.
"Can I wait with you?"
"No, you fucking can't," said another familiar voice.
Strike had arrived, massive, scowling, glaring at the stranger, who retreated with ill grace to a couple of friends at the bar.
"What are you doing here?"
asked Robin, surprised to find that her tongue felt numb and thick after two glasses of wine.
"Looking for you," said Strike.
"How did you know I was—"
"I'm a detective. How many of those have you had?" he asked, looking down at her wine glass.
"Only one,"
she lied. So he went to the bar for another and a pint of Doom Bar for himself. As he ordered, a large man in a beanie hat ducked out of the door, but Strike was more interested in keeping an eye on the blonde man who was staring over at Robin, and only seemed to give up on her once Strike reappeared, glowering, with two drinks, and sat down opposite her.
"What's going on?"
"Nothing."
"Don't give me that. You look like bloody death."
"Well," said Robin, taking a large slurp of wine, "consider my morale boosted."
Strike gave a short laugh.
"Why have you got a holdall with you?"
When she did not answer, he said,
"Where's your engagement ring?"
She opened her mouth to answer, but a treacherous desire to cry rose to drown the words. After a short inner struggle and another gulp of wine, she said,
"I'm not engaged anymore."
"Why not?"
"This is rich coming from you."
"I'm drunk," she thought, as though watching herself from outside her own body.
"Look at me. I'm drunk on 2.5 glasses of wine, no food, and no sleep."
"What's rich?" asked Strike, confused.
"We don't talk about personal... You don't talk about personal stuff."
"I seem to remember spilling my guts all over you in this very pub."
"Once," said Robin.
Strike deduced from her pink cheeks and her thickened speech that she was not on her second glass of wine. Both amused and concerned, he said,
"I think you need something to eat."
"That's exactly what I said to you," Robin replied, "that night when you were, and we ended up having a kebab. And I do not," she said with dignity, "want a kebab."
"Well," said Strike, "you know it's London. We can probably find you something that isn't a kebab."
"I like crisps,"
said Robin. So he bought her some.
"What's going on?" he repeated on his return.
After a few seconds of watching her attempting to open the crisps, he took them from her to do it himself.
"Nothing. I'm going to sleep in a travel lodge tonight, that's all."
"A travel lodge?"
"Yeah. There's one...
She looked down at her dead mobile and realized that she had forgotten to charge it the previous night.
"I can't remember where it is," she said. "Just leave me, I'm fine," she added,
groping in her holdall for something to blow her nose on.
"Yeah," he said heavily. "I'm totally reassured now I've seen you."
"I am fine," she said fiercely. "I'll be at work as usual tomorrow. You wait and see."
"You think I came to find you because I'm worried about work?"
"Don't be nice,"
she groaned, burying her face in her tissues.
"I can't take it. Be normal."
"What's normal?"
he asked, confused.
"Grumpy and uncommunic...
What do you want to communicate about?"
Nothing in particular, she lied. I just thought, keep things professional.
What's happened between you and Matthew?
What's happening between you and Ellen? She countered.
How's that important? He asked, nonplussed.
Same thing, she said vaguely, draining her third glass. I'd like another.
You're having a soft drink this time.
She examined the ceiling while waiting for him. There were theatrical scenes painted up there, bottom cavorted with Titania amid a group of fairies.
Things are going okay with Ellen, he told her when he sat back down, having decided that an exchange of information was the easiest way to make her talk about her own problems. It suits me, keeping it low-key. She's got a daughter who she doesn't want me getting too close to. Messy divorce.
Oh, said Robin, blinking at him over her glass of Coke. How did you meet her?
Through Nick and Ilse.
How do they know her?
They don't. They had a party and she came along with her brother. He's a doctor, works with Nick. They hadn't ever met her before.
Oh,
said Robin again. She had briefly forgotten her own troubles, diverted by this glimpse into Strike's private world. So normal, so unremarkable. A party, and he had gone along and got talking to the beautiful blonde. Women like Strike. She had come to realize that over the months they had worked together. She had not understood the appeal when she had started working for him. He was so very different from Matthew.
Does Ilse like Ellen? Asked Robin.
Strike was startled by this flash of perception.
Yeah, I think so, he lied.
Robin sipped her Coke.
Okay, said Strike, restraining his impatience with difficulty. Your turn.
We've split up, she said.
Interrogation technique told him to remain silent, and after a minute or so, the decision was vindicated.
He told me something, she said, last night.
Strike waited.
And we can't go back from that. Not that.
She was pale and composed, but he could almost feel the anguish behind the words. Still, he waited.
He slept with someone else,
she said in a small, tight voice. There was a pause. She picked up her crisp packet, found that she had finished the contents, and dropped it on the table.
Shit, said Strike.
He was surprised, not that Matthew had slept with another woman, but that he had admitted it. His impression of the handsome young accountant was of a man who knew how to run his life to suit himself, to compartmentalize and categorize where necessary.
And not just once, said Robin, in that same tight voice. He was doing it for months, with someone we both knew, Sarah Shadlock. She's an old friend of his from university.
Christ, said Strike. I'm sorry.
He was sorry, genuinely sorry, for the pain she was in. Yet the revelation had caused certain other feelings, feelings he usually kept under tight rein, considering them both misguided and dangerous, to flex inside him, to test their strength against their restraining bonds.
Don't be a stupid fucker, he told himself. That's one thing that can never happen. It'd screw everything up royally. What made him tell you? Strike asked.
She did not answer, but the question brought back the scene in awful clarity. Their Magnolia sitting room was far too tiny to accommodate a couple in such a state of fury. They had driven all the way home from Yorkshire in the Land Rover that Matthew had not wanted. Somewhere along the way, an incensed Matthew had asserted that it was a matter of time before Strike made a pass at Robin, and what was more, he suspected that she would welcome the advance.
He's my friend, that's all,
she had bellowed at Matthew from beside their cheap sofa, their weekend bag still in the hall.
For you to suggest I'm turned on by the fact he's had his leg, you're so bloody naive, he had bellowed. He's your friend until he tries to get you into bed, Robin. Who are you judging him by? Are you biding your time before you jump on your co-workers?
Of course I'm bloody not. But you're so frigging starry-eyed about him. He's a man. It's just the two of you in the office. He's my friend. Like you're friends with Sarah Shadlock, but you've never...
She had seen it in his face. An expression she had never noticed before passed across it like a shadow. Guilt seemed to slide physically over the high cheekbones, the clean jaw, the hazel eyes she had adored for years. "Have you?" she said, her tone suddenly wondering.
"Have you?"
He hesitated too long. "No," he had said forcefully, like a paused film jerking back into action. "Of course not."
"You have," she said. "You've slept with her."
She could see it in his face. He did not believe in male-female friendships because he had never had one. He and Sarah had been sleeping together.
"When?"
she had asked.
"Not... was it then?"
"I didn't..."
She heard the feeble protestation of a man who knows he has lost, who had even wanted to lose. That had haunted her all night and all day. On some level, he had wanted Robin to know. Her strange calm, more stunned than accusatory, had led him on to tell her everything. Yes, it had been, then. He felt terrible about it, he always had. But he and Robin hadn't been sleeping together at the time, and one night Sarah had been comforting him and, well, things had got out of hand.
"She was comforting you,"
Robin had repeated. Rage had come then at last, unfreezing her from her state of stunned disbelief.
"She was comforting you?"
"It was a difficult time for me too, you know," he had shouted.
Strike watched as Robin shook her head unconsciously, trying to clear it, but the recollections had turned her pink and her eyes were sparkling again.
"What did you say?"
she asked Strike, confused.
"I asked what made him tell you."
"I don't know. We were in the middle of a row. He thinks..."
She took a deep breath. Two-thirds of a bottle of wine on an empty stomach was leading her to emulate Matthew's honesty.
"He doesn't believe you and I are just friends."
This was no surprise to Strike. He had read suspicion in every look Matthew had ever given him, heard insecurity in every chippy comment thrown his way.
"So,"
Robin went on unsteadily,
"I pointed out that we are just friends, and that he's got a platonic friend himself, dear old Sarah Shadlock. So then it all came out. He and Sarah had an affair at university while I was at home."
"That long ago?" Strike said.
"You think I shouldn't mind if it was 7 years ago?" she demanded. "If he's lied about it ever since and we constantly see her."
"I was just surprised," said Strike, evenly, refusing to be drawn into a fight, "that he's owned up to it after all this time."
"Oh," said Robin. "Well, he was ashamed. Because of when it happened."
"At university?" asked Strike, confused.
"It was right after I dropped out," said Robin.
"Ah," said Strike.
They had never discussed what had made her leave her psychology degree and return to Masson. Robin had not intended to tell Strike the story, but all resolutions were adrift tonight on the little sea of alcohol with which she had filled her hungry and exhausted body. What did it matter if she told him? Without that information, he would not have the full picture or be able to advise her what to do next. She was relying on him, she realized dimly, to help her. Whether she liked it or not, whether he liked it or not, Strike was her best friend in London. She had never looked that fact squarely in the face before. Alcohol buoyed you up, and it washed your eyes clean. In vino veritas, they said, didn't they? Strike would know. he had an odd occasional habit of quoting Latin.
"I didn't want to leave uni," said Robin slowly, her head swimming. "But something happened, and afterwards I had problems."
That was no good. That didn't explain it.
"I was coming home from a friend's, in another hall of residence," she said. "It wasn't that late, only 8 o'clock or something. But there had been a warning out about him on the local news."
That was no good either. Far too much detail. What she needed was a bald statement of fact, not to talk him through every little bit of it, the way she'd had to in court. She took a deep breath, looked into Strike's face, and read dawning comprehension there. Relieved not to have to spell it out, she asked,
"Please could I have some more crisps?"
When he returned from the bar, he handed them to her in silence. She did not like the look on his face.
"Don't go thinking, it doesn't make any difference," she said desperately.
"It was 20 minutes of my life. It was something that happened to me. It isn't me. It doesn't define me."
Strike guessed that they were phrases she had been led to embrace in some kind of therapy. He had interviewed rape victims. He knew the forms of words they were given to make sense of what, to a woman, was incomprehensible. A lot of things about Robin were explained now. The long allegiance to Matthew, for instance, the safe boy from home. However, the drunken Robin read in Strike's silence the thing she had most feared. A shift in the way he saw her, from equal to victim.
"It doesn't make any difference," she repeated furiously. "I'm still the same."
"I know that," he said. "But it's still one fucking horrible thing to have happened to you."
"Well, yes, it was," she muttered, mollified.
Then, firing up again, "My evidence got him. I noticed things about him while... He had this patch of white skin under his ear, they call it vitiligo, and one of his pupils was fixed, dilated." She was gabbling slightly now, wolfing down her third packet of crisps. "He tried to strangle me. I went limp and played dead, and he ran for it. He'd attacked 2 other girls wearing the mask, and neither of them could tell the police anything about him. My evidence got him put away."
"That doesn't surprise me," said Strike.
She found this response satisfactory. They sat in silence for a minute while she finished the crisps.
"Only afterwards I couldn't leave my room," she said, as though there had been no pause. "In the end, the university sent me home. I was only supposed to take a term off, but I never went back."
Robin contemplated this fact, staring into space. Matthew had urged her to stay at home. When her agoraphobia had resolved, which had taken more than a year, she had begun visiting him at his university in Bath, wandering hand in hand among dwellings of soft Cotswold stone, down sweeping Regency Crescents, along the tree-lined banks of the River Avon. Every time they had gone out with his friends, Sarah Shadlock had been there, braying at Matthew's jokes, touching his arm, leading the conversation constantly to the good times they all enjoyed when Robin, the tedious girlfriend from home, was not present.
"He was comforting me. It was a difficult time for me too, you know."
"Right," said Strike. "We've got to get you a place to spend tonight."
"I'm going to the travel..."
"No, you're not."
He did not want her staying in a place where anonymous people might wander the corridors unchallenged, or could walk in off the street. Perhaps he was being paranoid, but he wanted her somewhere that a scream would not be lost in the raucous cries at hen parties.
"I could sleep in the office," said Robin.
Swaying as she tried to stand, he grabbed her by the arm.
"If you've still got that camp, you're not sleeping in the office," he said. "I know a good place. My aunt and uncle stayed there when they came up to see the mousetrap. Come on, give me the hold-all."
He had once before put his arm around Robin's shoulders, but that had been quite different. He had been using her as a walking stick. This time, it was she who could barely move in a straight line. He found her waist and held her steady as they left the pub. Matthew, she said as they moved off, would not like this. Strike said nothing. In spite of everything he had heard, he was not as sure as Robin was that the relationship was over. They had been together 9 years, and there was a wedding dress ready and waiting in Massam. He had been careful to offer no criticism of Matthew that might be repeated to her ex-fiancé in the renewal of hostilities that was surely coming, because the accumulated ties of 9 years could not be severed in a single night. His reticence was for Robin's sake rather than his own. He had no fear of Matthew.
"Who was that man?"
asked Robin sleepily, after they had walked 100 yards in silence.
"Which man?" "That man this morning. I thought he might be the leg man. He scared the hell out of me."
"Ah, that's Shanker. He's an old friend."
"He's terrifying."
"Shanker wouldn't hurt you," Strike assured her.
Then, as an afterthought,
"But don't ever leave him alone in the office."
"Why not?"
"He'll nick anything that's not nailed down. He does nothing for nothing."
"Where did you meet him?"
The story of Shanker and Leda took them all the way to Frith Street, where quiet townhouses looked down upon them, exuding dignity and order.
"Here?"
said Robin, gazing open-mouthed up at Hazlitt's hotel.
"I can't stay here. This'll be expensive."
"I'm paying," said Strike. "Think of it as this year's bonus. No arguments," he added, as the door opened and a smiling young man stood back to let them in. "It's my fault you need somewhere safe."
The wood-panelled hall was cosy, with the feeling of a private house. There was only one way in, and nobody could open the front door from outside. When he had given the young man his credit card, Strike saw the unsteady Robin to the foot of the stairs.
"You can take tomorrow morning off if you—"
"I'll be there at 9, she said. "Cormorant, thanks for...
"Not a problem. Sleep well."
Frith Street was quiet as he closed the Hazlitt's door behind him. Strike set off, his hands deep in his pockets, lost in thought. She had been raped and left for dead. Holy shit. 8 days previously, some bastard had handed her a woman's severed leg, and she had not breathed a word of her past, not asked for special dispensation to take time off, nor deviated in any respect from the total professionalism she brought to work every morning. It was he, without even knowing her history, who had insisted on the best rape alarm, on nothing after dark, on checking in with her regularly through the working day. At the precise moment Strike became aware that he was walking away from Denmark Street rather than towards it, he spotted a man in a beanie hat 20 yards away, skulking on the corner of Soho Square. The amber tip of the cigarette swiftly vanished as the man turned and began to walk hurriedly away.
"Excuse me, mate."
Strike's voice echoed through the quiet square as he sped up. The man in the hat did not look back, but broke into a run.
"Oi, mate!"
Strike, too, began to run, his knee protesting with every jolting step. His quarry looked back once, then took a sharp left, Strike moving as fast as he could in pursuit. Entering Carlisle Street, Strike squinted ahead at the crowd clustered around the entrance of the Toucan, wondering whether his man had joined it. Panting, he ran on past the pub drinkers, drawing up at the junction with Dean Street and revolving on the spot, looking for his quarry. He had a choice of taking a left, a right, or continuing along Carlisle Street, and each offered a multitude of doorways and basement spaces in which the man in the beanie hat could have hidden, assuming he had not hailed a passing cab.
"Bollocks," Strike muttered.
His stump was sore against the end of his prosthesis. All he had was an impression of ample height and breadth, a dark coat and hat, and the suspicious fact that he had run when called, run before Strike could ask him for the time, or a light, or directions. He took a guess and headed right up Dean Street.
The traffic swooshed past him in either direction. For nearly an hour, Strike continued to prowl the area, probing into dark doorways and basement cavities. He knew this was almost certainly a fool's errand, but if they had been followed by the man who had sent the leg, he was clearly a reckless bastard who might not have been scared away from Robin's vicinity by Strike's ungainly pursuit. Men in sleeping bags glared at him as he moved far closer than members of the public usually dared. Twice he startled cats out from behind dustbins, but the man in the beanie hat was nowhere to be seen. Chapter 21. The damn call came, and I knew what I knew and didn't want to know. Blue Oyster Cult, live for me. Robin woke next day to a sore head and a weight in the pit of her stomach. In the time it took to roll over on unfamiliar crisp white pillows, the events of the previous evening seemed to come crashing down on her. Shaking her hair out of her face, she sat up and looked around. Between the carved posts of her wooden four-poster, she made out the dim outlines of a room barely illuminated by the line of brilliant light between brocade curtains. As her eyes became accustomed to the gilded gloom, she made out the portrait of a fat gentleman with mutton-chop whiskers framed in gilt. This was the kind of hotel in which you took an expensive city break, not where you slept off a hangover with a few hastily snatched clothes in a hold-all. Had Strike deposited her here in elegant old-fashioned luxury as preemptive compensation for the serious talk he would initiate today?
You're obviously in a very emotional place. I think it would be good if you took a break from work. 2/3 of a bottle of bad wine, and she had told him everything.
With a weak groan, Robin sank back on the pillows, covered her face with her arms, and succumbed to the memories that had regained all their power now that she was weak and miserable. The rapist had worn a rubber gorilla mask. He had held her down with one hand, and the weight of a whole arm on her throat, telling her she was about to die as he raped her, telling her he was going to choke the fucking life out of her. Her brain a scarlet cavity of screaming panic, his hands tightening like a noose around her neck. Her survival had hung on her ability to pretend that she was already dead. Later there had been days and weeks when she had felt as though she had in fact died, and was trapped in the body from which she felt entirely disconnected. The only way to protect herself, it had seemed, was to separate herself from her own flesh, to deny their connection. It had been a long time before she had felt able to take possession again. He had been soft-spoken in court, meek. "Yes, Your Honor. No, Your Honor." A nondescript middle-aged white man, florid in complexion, except for that white patch under his ear. His pale, washed-out eyes blinked too often, eyes that had been slits viewed through the holes in his mask. What he had done to her shattered her view of her place in the world, ended her university career, and drove her back to Masson. It forced her through the grueling court case in which the cross-examination had been almost as traumatic as the original attack, for his defense was that she had invited him into the stairwell for sex. Months after his gloved hands had reached out of the shadows and dragged her, gagging, into the cavity behind the stairs, she had not been able to stand physical contact, not even a gentle hug from a family member. He had polluted her first and only sexual relationship, so that she and Matthew had had to start again, with fear and guilt attending them every step of the way. Robin pressed her arms down over her eyes, as though she might obliterate it all from her mind by force. Now, of course, she knew that the young Matthew, whom she had considered a selfless paragon of kindness and understanding, had in fact been cavorting with a naked Sarah in his student house in Bath, while Robin lay on her lonely bed in Masson for hours at a stretch, staring blankly at Destiny's child. Alone in the sumptuous quiet of Hazlitt's, Robin contemplated for the first time the question of whether Matthew would have left her for Sarah had she been happy and unharmed, or even whether she and Matthew might have grown naturally apart if she had completed her degree. She lowered her arms and opened her eyes. They were dry today. She felt as though she had no tears left to weep. The pain of Matthew's confession no longer pierced her. She felt it as a dull ache, underlying the more urgent panic about the damage she feared she might have done to her work prospects. How could she have been so stupid as to tell Strike what had happened to her? Hadn't she already learned what happened when she was honest? A year after the rape, when the agoraphobia had been overcome, when her weight was nearly back to normal, when she was itching to get back out into the world and make up the time she had lost, she had expressed a vague interest in something related to criminal investigative work. Without her degree, and with her confidence so recently shredded, she had not dared voice aloud her true desire to be some kind of investigator. A good thing, too, because every single person she knew had tried to dissuade her even from her tentatively expressed desire to explore the outer reaches of police work, even her mother, usually the most understanding of creatures. They had all taken what they thought a strange new interest as a sign of continuing sickness, a symptom of her inability to throw off what had happened to her. It was not true. The desire had long predated the rape. At the age of 8, she had informed her brothers that she was going to catch robbers and had been roundly mocked, for no better reason than that she ought to be laughed at, given that she was a girl and their sister. Though Robin hoped that their response was not a true reflection of their estimate of her abilities, but based on a kind of collegiate male reflex, it had left her diffident about expressing her interest in detective work to 3 loud, opinionated brothers. She had never told anyone that she had chosen to study psychology with a secret eye towards investigative profiling. Her pursuit of that goal had been utterly thwarted by the rapist. That was another thing he had taken from her. Asserting her ambition while recuperating from a state of intense fragility, at a time when everyone around her appeared to be waiting for her to fall apart again, had proved too difficult. Out of exhaustion and a feeling of obligation to the family that had been so protective and loving in her time of greatest need, she had let a lifelong ambition fall by the wayside, and everyone else had been satisfied to see it go. Then a temping agency had sent her by mistake to a private detective. She should have been there a week, but she had never left. It had felt like a miracle. Somehow, by luck, then through talent and tenacity, she had made herself valuable to the struggling Strike and ended up almost exactly where she had fantasized being before a total stranger had used her for his perverse enjoyment like a disposable inanimate object, then beaten and throttled her. Why? Why had she told Strike what had happened to her? He had been worried about her before she revealed her history. Now what? He would decide she was too fragile to work, Robin was sure of it. And from there, it would be a swift, short step to the sidelines, because she was unable to take on all the responsibilities he needed a workmate to shoulder. The calm Georgian room silence and solidity was oppressive. Robin struggled out from under the heavy covers and crossed the sloping wooden floorboards to a bathroom with a claw-footed bath and no shower. 15 minutes later, as she was dressing, her mobile, which she had mercifully remembered to charge the previous night, rang on the dressing table.
"Hi," said Strike. "How are you?"
"Fine," she said, her voice brittle. He had called to tell her not to come in. She knew it.
"Wardle's just phoned. They've found the rest of the body."
Robin sat down hard on the needlepoint stool, both hands clutching the mobile to her ear.
"What? Where? Who is she?"
"Tell you when I pick you up. They want to talk to us. I'll be outside at 9. Make sure you eat something," he added.
"Cormoran,"
she said, to stop him hanging up.
"What?"
I've still got a job then."
There was a slight pause.
"What are you talking about? Of course you've still got a job.
You don't... I'm still... Nothing's changed, she said.
Are you going to do as you're told? He asked. When I say nothing after dark, you're going to listen from now on.
Yes, she said, a little shakily.
Good. I'll see you at 9.
Robin breathed a deep, shuddering sigh of relief. She was not finished. He still wanted her. As she went to replace the mobile on the dressing table, she noticed that the longest text message that she had ever received had arrived overnight. Robin, I can't sleep for thinking about you. You don't know how much I wish it hadn't happened. It was a shitty thing to do, and there's no defense. I was 21, and I didn't know then what I know now. That there's nobody like you, and that I could never love anyone else as much as I love you. There's never been anyone apart from you since then. I've been jealous of you and Strike, and you might say I don't have the right to feel jealous because of what I did. But maybe on some level, I think you deserve better than me, and that's what's been getting to me. I only know I love you, and I want to marry you, and if that's not what you want now, then I'll have to accept that. But please, Robin, just text me and let me know you're okay, please. Matt. 7 kisses. Robin put the mobile back on the dressing table and continued dressing. She ordered a croissant and coffee from room service and was surprised how much better food and drink made her feel when they arrived. Only then did she read Matthew's text again. Maybe on some level I think you deserve better than me, and that's what's been getting to me. This was touching, and most unlike Matthew, who frequently expressed the view that citing subconscious motivation was no more than chicanery. Hard on the heels of that thought, though, came the reflection that Matthew would never cut Sarah out of his life. She was one of his best friends from university, embracing him tenderly at his mother's funeral, dining out with them as part of a cozy foursome, still flirting with Matthew, still stirring between him and Robin. After a brief inner deliberation, Robin texted back, "I'm fine." She was waiting for Strike on the doorstep of Hazlitt's, neat as ever, when the black cab drew up at 5 to 9. Strike had not shaved, and as his beard grew with vigour, his jaw looked grimy.
"Have you seen the news?" he asked, as soon as she had got into the cab.
"No."
"Media have just got it. Saw it on the telly as I left."
He leaned forward to slide shut the plastic divider between themselves and the driver.
"Who is she?" asked Robin.
"They haven't formally ID'd her yet, but they think she's a 24-year-old Ukrainian woman."
"Ukrainian?" said Robin, startled.
"Yeah." He hesitated, then said, "Her landlady found her dismembered in a fridge freezer in what looks like her own flat. The right leg's missing. It's definitely her."
The taste of Robin's toothpaste in her mouth turned chemical. Croissant and coffee churned in her stomach.
"Where's the flat?"
"Conyngham Road, Shepherd's Bush. Ring any bells?"
"No, I... Oh, God. Oh, God. The girl who wanted to cut off her leg."
"Apparently."
"But she didn't have a Ukrainian name, did she?"
"Wardle thinks she might have been using a fake one. You know, hooker name."
The taxi bore them down Pall Mall towards New Scotland Yard. White neoclassical buildings slid past the windows on both sides, august, haughty, and impervious to the shocks of frail humanity.
"It's what Wardle expected," said Strike, after a long pause. "His theory was that the leg belonged to a Ukrainian prostitute last seen with Digger Malley."
Robin could tell that there was more. She looked at him anxiously.
"There were letters from me in her flat," said Strike. "2 letters signed with my name."
"But you didn't write back."
"Wardle knows they're fake. Apparently they spelled my name wrong, Cameron. But he's still got to get me in."
"What do the letters say?"
"He wouldn't tell me over the phone. He's being pretty decent," said Strike, "not being a dick about it."
Buckingham Palace rose up ahead of them. The gigantic marble statue of Queen Victoria frowned down on Robin's confusion and her hangover, then slid out of view.
They're probably going to ask us to look at pictures of the body to see whether we can ID her.
Okay, said Robin, more stoutly than she felt.
How are you? Asked Strike.
I'm fine, she said. Don't worry about me.
I was going to call Wardle this morning anyway.
Why?
Last night, walking away from Hazlitt's, I saw a big guy in a black beanie hat lurking down a side street. There was something about his body language I didn't like. I called out to him. I was going to ask him for a light and he scarpered.
Don't, said Strike, though Robin had not made a sound, tell me I'm jumpy or imagining things. I think he followed us and I'll tell you something else. I think he was in the pub when I arrived. I didn't see his face, just the back of his head as he left.
To his surprise, Robin did not dismiss him. Instead, she frowned in concentration, trying to recall a vague impression.
You know, I saw a big bloke in a beanie hat somewhere yesterday too. Yeah, he was in a doorway on Tottenham Court Road. His face was in shadow, though.
Strike muttered another oath under his breath.
Please don't tell me to stop working, said Robin in a more high-pitched voice than usual. Please. I love this job.
And if the fucker's stalking you?
She could not repress a frisson of fear, but determination overrode it. To help catch this animal, whoever he was, would be worth almost anything.
I'll be vigilant. I've got two rape alarms.
Strike did not look reassured.
They disembarked at New Scotland Yard and were shown upstairs at once into an open-plan office where Wardle stood in his shirt sleeves talking to a group of subordinates. When he saw Strike and Robin, he left his colleagues at once and led the detective and his partner into a small meeting room.
Vanessa, he called through the door as Strike and Robin took seats at an oval table. Have you got the letters?
Detective Sergeant Equenzi appeared shortly afterwards with two typewritten sheets, protected in plastic slips, and a copy of what Strike recognized as one of the handwritten letters that he had given Wardle in the old blue last. Detective Sergeant Equenzi, who greeted Robin with a smile that the latter again found disproportionately reassuring, sat down beside Wardle with a notebook.
You want coffee or anything? Wardle asked.
Strike and Robin shook their heads. Wardle slid the letters across the table to Strike.
He read both before pushing them sideways to Robin. I didn't write either of them, Strike told Wardle.
I didn't think so, said Wardle.
You didn't answer on Strike's behalf, Miss Ellicott.
Robin shook her head.
The first letter admitted that Strike had indeed arranged the removal of his own leg because he wished to be rid of it, confessing that the story of an Afghan IED was an elaborate cover-up, and that he did not know how Kelsey had found this out, but implored her not to tell anybody else. The fake Strike then agreed to help her with her own encumbrance and asked where and when they could meet face to face. The second letter was brief, confirming that Strike would come and visit her on the 3rd of April at 7 p.m. Both of the letters were signed Cameron Strike, in thick black ink.
That, said Strike, who had pulled the second letter back towards him after Robin had finished reading it, reads as though she wrote back to me suggesting a time and place.
That was going to be my next question, said Wardle. Did you get a second letter?
Strike looked towards Robin, who shook her head.
Okay, said Wardle. For the record, when did the original letter from...
He checked the photocopy.
Kelsey, she signed herself. Come in.
Robin answered. I've got the envelope back in the nut. The ghost of a smile passed over Strike's face. In the drawer where we keep unsolicited letters. We can check the postcode, but as far as I can remember, it was early this year, maybe February.
Okay, excellent, said Wardle. We'll be sending someone over to retrieve that envelope.
He smiled at Robin, who was looking anxious. Calm down. I believe you. Some total nutter's trying to frame Strike. None of it hangs together. Why would he stab a woman, dismember her, and then mail her leg to his own office? Why would he leave letters from himself in the flat? Robin tried to smile back.
She was stabbed, interposed Strike. They're working on what actually killed her, said Wardle. But there are two deep wounds to the torso they're pretty sure would have done it before he started cutting her up.
Beneath the tabletop, Robin made fists, her nails digging deep into her palms.
Now, said Wardle, and Detective Sergeant Aquenzi clicked out the nib of her pen and prepared to write. Does the name Oksana Voloshina mean anything to either of you?
No,
said Strike, and Robin shook her head.
It looks like that was the victim's real name, Wardle explained. That's how she signed her tenancy agreement, and the landlady says she provided ID. She was claiming to be a student.
Claiming? Said Robin.
We're looking into who she really was, said Wardle.
Of course, thought Robin. He's expecting her to be a prostitute.
Her English was good, judging by her letter, commented Strike. That's if she genuinely wrote it.
Robin looked at him, confused.
If someone's faking letters from me, why couldn't they have faked the letter from her? Strike asked her.
To try and get you to genuinely communicate with her, you mean?
Yeah. Lure me to a rendezvous or lay some kind of paper trail between us that would look incriminating once she was dead.
Van, go and see if the photos of the body are viewable, said Wardle. Detective Sergeant Aquenzi left the room. Her posture was that of a model. Robin's insides began to crawl with panic. As though Wardle had sensed it, he turned to her and said,
I don't think you'll need to look at them if Strike...
She should look, said Strike.
Wardle looked taken aback, and Robin, though she tried not to show it, found herself wondering whether Strike was trying to scare her into compliance with his nothing-after-dark rule.
Yes, she said, with a decent show of calm. I think I should.
They're not nice, said Wardle, with uncharacteristic understatement.
The leg was sent to Robin, Strike reminded him. There's as much chance that she's seen this woman previously as I have. She's my partner, we work the same jobs.
Robin glanced sideways at Strike. He had never before described her as his partner to somebody else, or not within Robin's hearing. He was not looking at her. Robin switched her attention back to Wardle. Apprehensive though she was, after hearing Strike put her on equal professional footing with himself, she knew that, whatever she was about to see, she would not let herself or him down. When Detective Sergeant Aquenzi returned, holding a sheet of photographs in her hand, Robin swallowed hard and straightened her back. Strike took them first, and his reaction was not reassuring.
Holy fucking shit.
The head's best preserved, said Wardle quietly, because he put it in the freezer.
Just as she would have withdrawn her hand instinctively from something red hot, Robin now had to fight a powerful urge to turn away, to close her eyes, to flip the photograph over. Instead, she took it from Strike and looked down. Her intestines became liquid. The severed head sat on what remained of its neck, staring blindly into the camera, its eyes so frosted their colour was invisible. The mouth gaped darkly. Her brown hair was stiff, flecked with ice. The cheeks were full and chubby, the chin and forehead covered in acne. She looked younger than 24.
Do you recognise her?
Wardle's voice sounded startlingly close to Robin. She had felt as though she had travelled a long distance as she stared at the severed head.
No, said Robin.
She put the picture down and took the next from Strike. A left leg and two arms had been rammed into the fridge, where they had begun to decompose. Having steeled herself for the head, She had not thought anything else could be as bad, and she was ashamed of the small bleat of distress that escaped her.
"Yeah, it's bad," said Detective Sergeant De Quincey quietly. Robin met her eyes with gratitude.
"There's a tattoo on the wrist of the left arm," Wardle pointed out, handing them a third picture in which the relevant arm lay outstretched on a table. Now feeling definitely nauseated, Robin looked and made out 1D in black ink.
"You don't need to see the torso," said Wardle, shuffling the photographs and handing them back to Detective Sergeant De Quincey.
"Where was it?" asked Strike.
"In the bath," said Wardle.
"That's where he killed her, the bathroom. It looked like an abattoir in there."
He hesitated.
The leg wasn't the only thing he cut off her. Robin was glad that Strike did not ask what else had gone. She did not think she could stand to hear.
"Who found her?" asked Strike.
"The landlady," said Wardle. "She's elderly and she collapsed right after we got there. Looks like a heart attack. They took her to Hammersmith Hospital."
"What made her go round?"
"Smell," said Wardle.
"Downstairs had rung her. She decided to pop in early before doing her shopping, try and catch this Oksana at home. When she didn't answer, the landlady let herself in."
"Downstairs hadn't heard anything? Screams? Anything?"
"It's a converted house full of students, less than bloody useless," said Wardle. "Loud music, mates coming and going all hours. They gaped like sheep when we asked them if they'd heard anything from upstairs. The girl who'd rung the landlady had total hysterics. She said she'd never forgive herself for not phoning up when she first smelled something bad."
"Yeah, that would have changed everything," said Strike. "You could have stuck her head back on and she'd have been fine."
Wardle laughed. Even Detective Sergeant De Quincey smiled. Robin stood up abruptly. Last night's wine and this morning's croissant were churning horribly in her guts. Excusing herself in a small voice, she moved briskly towards the door.
Chapter 22. "I don't give up, but I ain't a stalker. I guess I'm just an easy talker. Blue Oyster Cult, I just like to be bad."
"Thank you, I get the concept of gallows humour," said Robin an hour later, part exasperated, part amused. "Can we move on?"
Strike regretted his witticism in the meeting room, because Robin had returned from a 20-minute bathroom trip, looking white and slightly clammy, a whiff of peppermint revealing that she had cleaned her teeth again. Instead of taking a taxi, he had suggested they take a short walk in the fresh air along Broadway to the Feathers, the closest pub, where he ordered them a pot of tea. Personally, he was ready for a beer, but Robin had not been trained up to consider alcohol and bloodshed natural fellows, and he felt a pint might reinforce her impression of his callousness. The Feathers was quiet at 11:30 on a Wednesday morning. They took a table at the back of the large pub, away from a couple of plain-clothes officers who were talking in soft voices near the window.
"I told Wardle about our friend in the beanie while you were in the bathroom," Strike told Robin. "He says he's going to put a plain-clothes man around Denmark Street to keep an eye out for a few days."
"Do you think the press are going to come back?" asked Robin, who had not yet had time to worry about this.
"I hope not. Wardle's going to keep the fake letters under wraps. He says it's playing into this nutter's hands to release them. He inclines to the view that the killer's genuinely trying to frame me."
"You don't?"
"No," said Strike. "He's not that unhinged. There's something weirder going on here."
He fell silent, and Robin, respecting his thought process, maintained her own silence.
"Terrorism. That's what this is," said Strike slowly, scratching his unshaven chin. "He's trying to put the wind up us, disrupt our lives as much as possible. And let's face it, he's succeeding.
We've got police crawling over the office and calling us into the yard. We've lost most of our clients. You're...
Don't worry about me, said Robin at once.
I don't want you to worry. For fuck's sake, Robin, said Strike on a flash of temper. Both of us saw that guy yesterday. Wardle thinks I should tell you to stay home, and I...
Please, she said, her early morning fears swarming back upon her. Don't make me stop work.
It's not worth being murdered to escape your home life.
He regretted saying it immediately, as he saw her wince. I'm not using it as an escape, she muttered. I love this job. I woke up this morning feeling sick about what I told you last night. I was worried you might not think I'm tough enough anymore.
This hasn't got anything to do with what you told me last night, and nothing to do with being tough. It's about a psycho who might be following you who's already hacked a woman to bits.
Robin drank her lukewarm tea and said nothing. She was ravenous. However, the thought of eating pub food containing any form of meat made sweat break out over her scalp.
It can't have been a first murder, can it?
Strike asked rhetorically, his dark eyes fixed on the hand-painted names of beers over the bar.
Beheading her, cutting off her limbs, taking bits of her away. Wouldn't you work up to that?
You'd think so, Robin agreed.
That was done for the pleasure of doing it. He had a one-man orgy in that bathroom.
Robin was now unsure whether she was experiencing hunger or nausea.
A sadistic maniac who's got a grudge against me and has decided to unite his hobbies.
Strike mused aloud. Does that fit any of the men you suspect? Robin asked. Have any of them killed before, that you know of?
Yeah, said Strike. Whittaker. He killed my mother.
But in a very different way, thought Robin. It had been a needle, not knives, that had dispatched Leda Strike. Out of respect for Strike, who was looking grim, she did not voice the thought. Then she remembered something else. I suppose you know, she said cautiously, that Whittaker kept another woman's dead body in his flat for a month.
Yeah, said Strike, I heard.
The news had filtered through to him while he was out in the Balkans, passed on by his sister Lucy. He had found a picture online of Whittaker walking into court. His ex-stepfather had been almost unrecognizable, crew-cutted and bearded, but still with those staring gold eyes. Whittaker's story, if Strike remembered correctly, had been that he had been afraid of another false accusation of murder, so he had attempted to mummify the dead woman's body, binding it up in bin bags and hiding it under floorboards. The defense had claimed to an unsympathetic judge that their client's novel approach to his problem was due to heavy drug use. He hadn't murdered her, though, had he? Robin asked, trying to remember exactly what Wikipedia had said.
She'd been dead a month, so I doubt it was an easy post-mortem, said Strike.
The look that Shanker had described as ugly had returned.
Personally, I'd lay odds he killed her. How unlucky does a man get? Two of his girlfriends dropping dead at home while he's sitting there doing nothing. He liked death, Whittaker. He liked bodies. He claimed he'd been a gravedigger when he was a teenager. He had a thing about corpses. People took him for a hardcore goth or some ten-a-penny poser. The necrophiliac lyrics, the satanic Bible, Aleister Crowley, all that crap. But he was an evil, amoral bastard who told everyone he met he was an evil, amoral bastard. And what happened? Women fell over themselves to get at him. I need a drink, said Strike.
He got up and headed for the bar. Robin watched him go, slightly taken aback by his sudden rush of anger. His opinion that Whittaker had murdered twice was unsupported by either the courts or, as far as she knew, police evidence. She had become used to Strike's insistence on the meticulous collection and documentation of facts, his oft-repeated reminders that hunches and personal antipathies might inform
but must never be allowed to dictate the direction of an investigation. Of course, when it was a case